So, Sed is famous in your homeland?
I've not heard of him, Lord.
I think of him as a symbol, Alfred said. A man who was born in East Anglia, did his life's work in Mercia, and died in Northumbria.
He brought his long, pale hands together so that the fingers embraced.
The Saxons of England, Uhtred, gathered together before God.
And united in joyful prayer with the Britons, Asser added piously.
I beseech Almighty God for that happy outcome, the king said, smiling at me. And by now I recognize what he was saying. He stood there, looking so humble, with no crown, no great necklace, no arm rings, nothing but a small garnet brooch holding the cloak at his neck, and he spoke of a happy outcome. But what he was really seeing was the Saxon people gathered under one king, a king of Wessex. Alfred's piety hid a monstrous ambition.
We must learn from the saints, Alfred told me. Their lives are a guide to the darkness that surrounds us, and Saint Sed's holy example teaches that we must be united. So I am loath to shed Saxon blood on Saint Sed's feast day.
There need be no bloodshed, Lord, I said.
I am pleased to hear it, Alfred interjected.
If the charges against me are retracted. The smile went from his face, and he walked to the window and stared into the misty courtyard, and I looked where he looked, and saw that a small display was being mounted for my benefit. Stiappa was being armoured. Two men were dropping a massive mail coat over his wide shoulders, while a third stood by with an outsized shield and a monstrous sword.
I talked with Stiappa last night, the king said, turning from the window. And he told me there was a mist when Svein attacked at Sinuit. A morning mist like this one.
He waved at the whiteness sifting into the chapel. I wouldn't know, Lord, I said.
So it is possible, the king went on, that Stiappa was mistaken when he thought he saw you.
I almost smiled. The king knew Stiappa had lied, though he would not say as much.
Father Willibald also spoke to the crew of the Eftweed, the king went on, and not one of them confirmed Stiappa's tale.
The crew was still in Hampton, so Willibald's report must have come from there, and that meant the king had known I was innocent of the slaughter at Sinuit even before I was charged. So I was falsely arraigned, I said harshly.
You were accused, the king corrected me. And accusations must be proven or refuted.
Or withdrawn.
I can withdraw the charges, Alfred agreed.
Stiappa outside the window was making sure his mail coat was seated comfortably by swinging his great sword. And it was great. It was huge, a hammer of a blade. Then the king half closed the shutter, hiding Stiappa.
I can withdraw the accusation about Sinuit, he said. But I do not think Brother Asser lied to us.
I have a queen, I said. Who says he does?
A shadow queen, Asser hissed. A pagan. A sorceress.
He looked at Alfred.
She is evil, Lord, he said.
A witch. Maleficos non patieris vivere.
Thou shalt not permit a witch to live, Alfred translated for my benefit. That is God's commandment, Uhtred, from the Holy Scriptures.
Your answer to the truth, I sneered, is to threaten a woman with death. Alfred flinched at that.
Brother Asser is a good Christian,
he said vehemently,
and he tells the truth. You went to war without my orders. You used my ship, my men, and you behaved treacherously. You are a liar, Uhtred, and you are a cheat.
He spoke angrily, but managed to control his anger.
It is my belief, he went on, that you have paid your debt to the church with goods stolen from other good Christians.
Not true, I said harshly. I'd paid the debt with goods stolen from a Dane.
So resume the debt, the king said,
and we shall have no death on this blessed day of St. Sed.
I was being offered life. Alfred waited for my response, smiling. He was sure I would accept his offer, because to him it seemed reasonable. He had no love for warriors, weapons, and killing. Fate decreed that he must spend his reign fighting, but it was not to his taste. He wanted to civilize Wessex, to give it piety and order, and two men fighting to the death on a winter's morning was not his idea of a well-run kingdom. But I hated Alfred. I hated him for humiliating me at Exoncester, when he had made me wear a penitent's robe and crawl on my knees. Nor did I think of him as my king. He was a West Saxon, and I was a Northumbrian, and I reckon so long as he was king, then Wessex had small chance of surviving. He believed God would protect him from the Danes, while I believed they had to be defeated by swords. I also had an idea how to defeat Stiapa. Just an idea. And I had no wish to take on a debt I'd already paid. And I was young, and I was foolish, and I was arrogant, and I was never able to resist a stupid impulse. "Everything I have said is the truth," I lied. "And I would defend that truth with my sword." Alfred flinched from my tone.
"Are you saying Brother Asser lied?" he demanded.
"He twists truth," I said, "like a woman wrings a hen's neck." The king pulled the shutter open, showing me the mighty Stiapa in his gleaming war glory.
"You really want to die?"
he asked me. "I want to fight for the truth, Lord King," I said stubbornly.
"Then you are a fool," Alfred said, his anger showing again. "You are a liar, a fool and a sinner."
He strode past me, pulled open the door, and shouted at a servant to tell Elderman Wulfhere that the fight was to take place after all.
"Go," he added to me, "and may your soul receive its just reward."
Wulfhere had been charged with arranging the fight, but there was a delay because the Elderman had disappeared. The town was searched, the royal buildings were searched, but there was no sign of him until a stable slave nervously reported that Wulfhere and his men had ridden away from Sippenham before dawn. No one knew why, though some surmised that Wulfhere wanted no part in a trial by combat, which made little sense to me, for the Elderman had never struck me as a squeamish man. Elderman Hupper of Thornseter was appointed to replace him, and so it was close to midday when my swords were brought to me, and we were escorted down to the meadow that lay across the bridge which led from the town's eastern gate. A huge crowd had gathered on the river's far bank. There were cripples, beggars, jugglers, women selling pies, dozens of priests, excited children, and, of course, the assembled warriors of the West Saxon nobility, all of them in Sippenham for the meeting of the Witan, and all eager to see Stiapa Snotor show off his renowned skill. "You're a damn fool," Leofric said to me. "Because I insisted on fighting." "You could have walked away." "And men would have called me a coward," I said. And that, too, was the truth. But a man cannot step back from a fight and stay a man. We make much in this life, if we are able. We make children, and wealth, and amass land, and build halls, and assemble armies, and give great feasts. But only one thing survives us. Reputation. I could not walk away. Alfred did not come to the fight. Instead, with the pregnant Aelswith and their two children, and escorted by a score of guards and as many priests and courtiers, he had ridden westwards. He was accompanying Brother Asser on the start of the monk's return journey to Dyfed, and the king was making a point that he preferred the company of the British churchmen to watching two of his warriors fight like snarling hounds. But no one else in Wessex wanted to miss the battle. They were eager for it. But Hupper wanted everything to be orderly, and so he insisted that the crowd push back from the damp ground beside the river to give us space. Eventually, The folk were massed on a green bank overlooking the trampled grass, and Hooper went to Stiapa to inquire if he was ready. He was ready. His mail shone in the weak sunlight. His helmet was glistening. His shield was a huge thing, bossed and rimmed with iron. A shield that must have weighed as much as a sack of grain, and was a weapon in itself, if he managed to hit me with it. But his chief weapon was his great sword, that was longer and heavier than any I had seen. Hooper, trailed by two guards, came to me. His feet squelched in the grass, and I thought that the ground would prove treacherous.
"Uhtred of Oxton," he said. "Are you ready?"
"My name," I said, "is Uhtred of Bebbanburg."
"Are you ready?"
he demanded, ignoring my correction.
"No,"
I said. A murmur went through the folk nearest to me, and the murmur spread, and after a few heartbeats the whole crowd was jeering me. They thought me a coward, and that thought was reinforced when I dropped my shield and sword and made Leofric help as I stripped off the heavy coat of mail. Odda the Younger, standing beside his champion, was laughing.
"What are you doing?"
Leofric asked me.
"I hope you put money on me," I said. "Course I didn't."
"Are you refusing to fight?"
Hooper asked me.
"No,"
I said. And when I was stripped of my armour, I took Serpent Breath back from Leofric. Just Serpent Breath. No helmet. No shield, just my good sword. Now I was unburdened. The ground was heavy. Stiapa was armoured, but I was light, and I was fast, and I was ready.
"I'm ready,"
I told Hooper. He went to the meadow's centre, raised an arm, dropped it, and the crowd cheered. I kissed the hammer around my neck, trusted my soul to the great god Thor, and walked forwards. Stiapa came steadily towards me, shield up, sword held out to his left. There was no trace of concern in his eyes. He was a workman at his trade, and I wondered how many men he had killed, and he must have thought my death would be easy, for I had no protection, not even a shield. And so we walked towards each other, until, a dozen paces from him, I ran. I ran at him, feinted right towards his sword, and then broke hard to my left, still running, going past him now, and I was aware of the huge blade swinging fast after me as he turned. But then I was behind him. He was still turning, and I dropped to my knees, ducked, heard the blade go over my head, and I was up again, lunging. The sword pierced his mail, drew blood from just behind his left shoulder, but he was quicker than I had expected, and had already checked that first great swing and was bringing the sword back, and his turn pulled Serpent Breath free. I'd scratched him. I danced back two paces. I went left again, and he charged me, hoping to crush me with the weight of his shield, but I ran back to the right, fending off the sword with Serpent Breath, and the crack of the blades was like the bell of doomsday, and I lunged again, this time aiming at his waist, but he stepped back quickly. I kept going to the right, my arm jarred by the clash of the swords. I went fast, making him turn, and I feinted a lunge, brought him forward, and went back to the left. The ground was boggy. I feared slipping, but speed was my weapon. I had to keep him turning, keep him swinging into empty air, and snatch what chances I could to use Serpent Breath's point. Bleed him enough, I thought, and he would tire. But he guessed my tactics and started making short rushes to frustrate me, and each rush would be accompanied by the hiss of that huge sword. He wanted to make me parry, and hoped he could break Serpent Breath when the blades met. I feared the same. She was well made, but even the best sword can break. He forced me back, trying to crowd me against the spectators on the bank so he could hack me to pieces in front of them. I let him drive me, then dodged to my right, where my left foot slipped, and I went down on that knee, and the crowd, close behind me now, took in a great breath, and a woman screamed because Stiapa's huge sword was swinging like an axe onto my neck. Only, I'd not slipped, merely pretended to,
and I pushed off with my right foot, came out from under the blow and around his right flank, and he thrust the shield out, catching my shoulder with the rim, and I knew I would have a bruise there. But I also had a heartbeat of opportunity, and I darted serpent breath forward, and at a point punctured his mail again to scrape against the ribs of his back, and he roared as he turned, wrenching my blade free of his mail. But I was already going backwards. I stopped 10 paces away. He stopped too and watched me. There was a slight puzzlement on his big face now. There was still no worry there, just puzzlement. He pushed his left foot forward, as Harald had warned me, and he was hoping I would attack it, and he would rely on the hidden iron strip in the boot to protect him, while he thumped and hacked and bludgeoned me to death. I smiled at him, and threw serpent breath from my right hand into my left, and held her there. And that was a new puzzle for him. Some men could fight with either hand, and perhaps I was one of them. He drew his foot back. "Why do they call you Stiapa Snotur?" I asked. "You're not clever. You got the brains of an addled egg." I was trying to enrage him, and hope that anger would make him careless, but my insult bounced off him. Instead of rushing me in fury, he came slowly, watching the sword in my left hand, and the men on the hill called for him to kill me, and I suddenly ran at him, broke right, and he swung at me a little late, thinking I was going to go left at the last moment, and I swept serpent breath back, and she caught his sword arm, and I could feel her blade scraping through the rings of his mail. But she did not slice through them, and then I was away from him, and put her back into my right hand, turned, charged him, and swerved away at the last moment, so that his massive swing missed me by a yard. He was still puzzled. This was like a bull baiting, and he was the bull. And his problem was to get me in a place where he could use his greater strength and weight. I was the dog, and my job was to lure him, tease him, and bite him until he weakened. He had thought I would come with mail and shield, and we would batter each other for a few moments, until my strength faded and he could drive me to the ground with massive blows and chop me to scraps with the big sword. But so far, his blade had not touched me. But nor had I weakened him. My two cuts had drawn blood, but they were mere scratches. So now he came forward again, hoping to herd me back to the river. A woman screamed from the top of the bank, and I assumed she was trying to encourage him. And the screaming grew louder, and I just went back faster, making Stiapa lumber forward. But I'd slipped away to his right, and was coming back at him, making him turn. And then he suddenly stopped, and stared past me, and his shield went down, and his sword dropped too, and all I had to do was lunge. He was there for the killing. I could thrust serpent breath into his chest or throat, or ram her into his belly. But I did none of those things. Stiapa was no fool at fighting, and I guessed he was luring me, and I did not take the bait. If I lunged, I thought, he would crush me between his shield and sword. He wanted me to think him defenceless, so that I could come into range of his weapons. But instead, I stopped and spread my arms, inviting him to attack me, as he was inviting me to attack him. But he ignored me. He just stared past my shoulder. And the woman screaming was shrill now, and there were men shouting, and Leofric was yelling my name, and the spectators were no longer watching us, but running in panic. So I turned my back on Stiapa, and looked towards the town on its hill that was cradled by the river's bend. And I saw that Sippenham was burning. Smoke was darkening the winter sky, and the horizon was filled with men, mounted men, men with swords and axes and shields and spears and banners, and more horsemen were coming from the eastern gate to thunder across the bridge, because all Alfred's prayers had failed, and the Danes had come to Wessex. Chapter 6. Stiapa recovered his wits before I did. He stared open-mouthed at the Danes crossing the bridge, and then just ran towards his master, Odda the Younger, who was shouting for his horses.
The Danes were spreading out from the bridge, galloping across the meadow with drawn swords and levelled spears. Smoke poured into the low wintry clouds from the burning town. Some of the king's buildings were alight. A riderless horse, stirrups flapping, galloped across the grass. Then Leofric grabbed my elbow and pulled me northwards beside the river. Most of the folk had gone south, and the Danes had followed them, so north seemed to offer more safety. Isolde had my mail cut, and I took it from her, leaving her to carry Wasp-Sting. And behind us, the screaming rose as the Danes chopped into the panic mass. Folk scattered. Escaping horsemen thumped past us, the hooves throwing up spadefuls of damp earth and grass with every step. I saw Odda the Younger swerve away with three other horsemen. Harald, the Shire Reeve, was one of them, but I could not see Siapa, and for a moment I feared the big man was looking for me. Then I forgot him, as a band of Danes turned north in pursuit of Odda. "Where are our horses?" I shouted at Leofric, who looked bemused, and I remembered he had not travelled to Sippenham with me. The beasts were probably still in the yard behind the Corncrake Tavern, which meant they were lost. There was a fallen willow in a stand of leafless alders by the river, and we paused there for breath, hidden by the willow's trunk. I pulled on the mail coat, buckled on my swords, and took my helmet and shield from Leofric. "Where's Hasten?" I asked.
"Well, you ran," Leofric said curtly.
So had the rest of my men. They had joined the panic and were gone southwards. Leofric pointed northwards.
"Trouble," he said curtly.
There was a score of Danes riding down our bank of the river, blocking our escape. But they were still some distance away, while the men pursuing Odda had vanished. So Leofric led us across the water meadow to a tangle of thorns, alders, nettles and ivy. At its centre was an old wattle hut, perhaps a herdsman's shelter, and though the hut had half collapsed, it offered a better hiding place than the willow, and so the three of us plunged into the nettles and crouched behind the rotting timbers. A bell was ringing in the town. It sounded like the slow tolling which announced a funeral. It stopped abruptly, started again, and then finally ended. A horn sounded. A dozen horsemen galloped close to our hiding place, and all had black cloaks and black painted shields, the marks of Guthrum's warriors. Guthrum. Guthrum the Unlucky. He called himself King of East Anglia, but he wanted to be King of Wessex, and this was his third attempt to take the country, and this time, I thought, his luck had turned. While Alfred had been celebrating the 12th night of Yule, and while the Witan met to discuss the maintenance of bridges and the punishment of malefactors, Guthrum had marched. The army of the Danes was in Wessex. Sippenham had fallen, and the great men of Alfred's kingdom had been surprised, scattered or slaughtered. The horn sounded again, and the dozen black-cloaked horsemen turned and rode towards the sound.
"We should have known the Danes were coming," I said angrily.
"You always said they would," Leofric said.
"Didn't Alfred have spies in Gloucester?"
"He had priests praying here instead," Leofric said bitterly. "And he trusted Guthrum's truce." I touched my hammer amulet. I'd taken it from a boy in the Uffelwick. I had been a boy myself then, newly captured by the Danes, and my opponent had fought me in a whirl of fists and feet, and I'd hammered him down into the riverbank and taken his amulet. I still have it. I touch it often, reminding Thor that I live. But that day, I touched it because I thought of Ragnar. The hostages would be dead. And was that why Wulfhere had ridden away at dawn? But how could he have known the Danes were coming? If Wulfhere had known, then Alfred would have known, and the West Saxon forces would have been ready. None of it made sense, except that Guthrum had again attacked during a truce, and the last time he had broken a truce, he had showed that he was willing to sacrifice the hostages held to prevent such an attack. It seemed certain he had done it again, and so Ragnar would be dead, and my world was diminished. So many dead. There were corpses in the meadow between our hiding place and the river, and still the slaughter went on.
Some of the Saxons had run back towards the town, discovered the bridge was guarded, and tried to escape northwards, and we watched them being ridden down by the Danes. Three men tried to resist, standing in a tight group with swords ready. But a Dane gave a great whoop and charged them with his horse, and his spear went through one man's mail, crushing his chest, and the other two were thrown aside by the horse's weight, and immediately more Danes closed on them. Swords and axes rose, and the horsemen spurred on. The girl screamed and ran in terrified circles, until a Dane, long hair flying, leaned from his saddle and pulled her dress up over her head, so she was blind and half-naked. She staggered in the damp grass, and a half-dozen Danes laughed at her. Then one slapped her bare rump with his sword, and another dragged her southwards, her screams muffled by the entangling dress. Isolt was shivering, and I put a mail-clad arm around her shoulders. I could have joined the Danes in the meadow. I spoke their language, and with my long hair and my arm rings, I looked like a Dane. But Hasten was somewhere in Sippenham, and he might betray me. And Guthrum had no great love for me, and even if I survived, then it would go hard with Leofric and Isolt. These Danes were in a rampant mood, flushed by their easy success, and if a dozen decided they wanted Isolt, then they would take her, whether they thought I was a Dane or not. They were hunting in packs, and so it was best to stay hidden until the frenzy had passed. Across the river, at the top of the low hill on which Sippenham was built, I could see the town's largest church burning. The thatch roof was whirling into the sky in great ribbons of flame, and plumes of spark-riddled smoke.
"What in God's name were you doing back there?" Leofric asked me.
"Back there?" His question confused me.
"Dancing around Stiapa like a gnat. He could have endured that all day."
"I wounded him," I said.
"Twice." "Wounded him? Sweet Christ! He's hurt himself worse when he was shaving."
"Doesn't matter now, does it?" I said. I guess Stiapa was dead by now. Or perhaps he had escaped. I did not know. None of us knew what was happening except that the Danes had come. And Mildrith? My son? They were far away, and presumably they would receive warning of the Danish attack. But I had no doubt that the Danes would keep going deep into Wessex, and there was nothing I could do to protect Oxton. I had no horse, no men, and no chance of reaching the south coast before Guthrum's mounted soldiers. I watched a Dane ride past with a girl across his saddle. "What happened to that Danish girl you took home?" I asked Leofric. "The one we captured off Wales."
"Well, she's still in Hampton," he said.
"And now that I'm not there, she's probably in someone else's bed."
"Probably?"
"Certainly."
"Well, then the bastard's welcome to her," he said. "She cries a lot."
"Mildrith does that," I said. And then, after a pause, "Aenfled was angry with you."
"Aenfled? Angry with me? Why?"
"Because you didn't go to see her."
"Well, how could I? I was in chains."
He looked satisfied that the whore had asked after him.
"Well, Aenfled doesn't cry, does she?"
"Well, not that I've seen."
"Good girl, that. I reckon she'd like Hampton."
If Hampton still existed. Had a Danish fleet come from London? Was Svein attacking across the Severn Sea? I knew nothing, except that Wessex was suffering chaos and defeat. It began to rain again. A thin winter's rain, cold and stinging. Isolt crouched lower, and I sheltered her with my shield. Most of the folk who had gathered to watch the fight by the river had fled south, and only a handful had come our way, which meant there were fewer Danes near our hiding place, and those that were in the northern river meadows were now gathering their spoils. They stripped the corpses of weapons, belts, mail, clothes, anything of value. A few Saxon men had survived, but they were being led away with the children and younger women to be sold as slaves. The old were killed. A wounded man was crawling on hands and knees, and a dozen Danes tormented him like cats playing with an injured sparrow, nicking him with swords and spears, bleeding him to a slow death. Hasten was one of the tormentors.
"I always liked Hasten,"
I said sadly.
"He's a Dane,"
Leofric said scornfully.
"I still liked him."
"You kept him alive,"
Leofric said.
"And now he's gone back to his own. You should have killed him."
I watched as Hasten kicked the wounded man, who called out in agony, begging to be killed. But the group of young men went on jabbing him, laughing, and the first ravens came. I've often wondered if ravens smell blood, for the sky can be clear of them all day, but when a man dies they come from nowhere on their shining black wings. Perhaps Odin sends them, for the ravens are his birds, and now they flap down to start feasting on eyes and lips, the first course of every raven feast. The dogs and foxes would soon follow.
"The end of Wessex," Leofric said sadly.
"The end of England," I said.
"What do we do?"
Isolde asked. There was no answer from me. Ragnar must be dead, which meant I had no refuge among the Danes, and Alfred was probably dead or else a fugitive. And my duty now was to my son. He was only a baby, but he was my son, and he carried my name. Bebbanburg would be his if I could take it back, and if I could not take it back, then it would be his duty to recapture the stronghold. And so the name Uhtred of Bebbanburg would go on till the last weltering chaos of the dying world.
"We must get to Hampton," Leofric said. "Find the crew."
Except the Danes would surely be there already, or else on their way. They knew where the power of Wessex lay, where the great lords had their halls, where the soldiers gathered. And Guthrum would be sending men to burn and kill, and so disarm the Saxons' last kingdom.
"We need food," I said. "Food and warmth."
"Light a fire here," Leofric grumbled. "And we're dead."
So we waited. The small rain turned to sleet. Hasten and his new companions, now that their victim was dead, wandered away, leaving the meadow empty, but for the corpses and their attendant ravens. And still we waited. But Isolde, who was as thin as Alfred, was shivering uncontrollably, and so, in the late afternoon, I took off my helmet and unbound my hair so it hung loose.
"What are you doing?"
Leofric asked.
"For the moment," I said, "we're Danes. Just keep your mouth shut." I led them towards the town. I would have preferred to wait until dark, but Isolde was too cold to wait longer, and I just hoped the Danes had calmed down. I might look like a Dane, but it was still dangerous. Hasten might see me, and if he told others how I had ambushed the Danish ship off Dyfed, then I could expect nothing but a slow death. So we went nervously, stepping past bloodied bodies along the riverside path. The ravens protested as we approached, flapped indignantly into the winter willows, and returned to their feast when we passed. There were more corpses piled by the bridge, where the young folk captured for slavery were being made to dig a grave. The Danes guarding them were drunk, and none challenged us as we went across the wooden span and under the gate arch that was still hung with holly and ivy in celebration of Christmas. The fires were dying now, damped by rain or else extinguished by the Danes, who were ransacking houses and churches. I stayed in the narrowest alleys, edging past a smithy, a hide dealer's shop, and a place where pots had been sold. Our boots crunched through the pottery shards. A young Dane was vomiting in the alley's entrance, and he told me that Guthrum was in the royal compound, where there would be a feast that night. He straightened up, gasping for breath, but was sober enough to offer me a bag of coins for Isolde. There were women screaming or sobbing in houses, and their noise was making Leofric angry, but I told him to stay quiet. two of us could not freeze Sippenham. And if the world had been turned upside down and it had been a West Saxon army capturing a Danish town, it would have sounded no different.
Alfred wouldn't allow it,
Leofric said sullenly.
You do it anyway, I said. You've done it.
I wanted news, but none of the Danes in the street made any sense. They had come from Gloucester, leaving long before dawn. They captured Sippenham, and now they wanted to enjoy whatever the town offered. The big church had burned, but men were raking through the smoking embers looking for silver. For lack of anywhere else to go, we climbed the hill to the Corncrake Tavern, where we always drank, and found Aenfled, the red-headed whore, being held on a table by two young Danes, while three others, none of them more than 17 or 18, took turns to rape her. Another dozen Danes were drinking peaceably enough, taking scant notice of the rape.
"You want her?"
one of the young men said.
"You'll have to wait."
"I want her now," I said.
"Then you can jump in the shit pit,"
he said. He was drunk. He had a wispy beard and insolent eyes.
"You can jump in the shit pit,"
he said again, evidently liking the insult, then pointed to Isolde.
"And I'll have her while you drown."
I hit him, breaking his nose and spattering his face with blood, and while he gasped, I kicked him hard between the legs. He went down, whimpering, and I hit a second man in the belly while Leofric loosed all his day's frustration in a savage attack on another. The two who had been holding Aenfled turned on us, and one of them squealed when Aenfled grabbed his hair and hooked sharp fingernails into his eyes. Leofric's opponent was on the floor, and he stamped on the boy's throat, and I head-slapped my boy until I had him by the door. Then I thumped another in the ribs, rescued Aenfled's victim and broke his jaw, then went back to the lad who had threatened to rape Isolde. I ripped a silver loop from his ear, took off his one arm ring, and stole his pouch that clinked with coins. I dropped the silver into Aenfled's lap, then kicked the groaning man between the legs, did it again, and hauled him out into the street.
"Go jump in a shit pit," I told him, then slammed the door.
The other Danes, still drinking on the tavern's far side, had watched the fight with amusement, and now gave us ironic applause.
"Bastards," Aenfled said,
evidently talking of the men we had driven away.
"I'm sore as hell. What are you two doing here?"
"They think we're Danes," I said.
"We need food,"
Leofric said.
"They've had most of it,"
Aenfled said, jerking her head at the seated Danes.
"But there might be something left in the back."
She tied her girdle.
"Edwulf's dead."
Edwulf had owned the tavern.
"And thanks for helping me, you spavin bastards!"
She shouted this at the Danes, who did not understand her, and just laughed at her. Then she went towards the back room to find us food. But one of the men held out a hand to stop her.
"Where are you going?"
he asked her in Danish. "She's going past you," I called.
"I want ale,"
he said.
"And you? Who are you?"
"I'm the man who's going to cut your throat if you stop her fetching food," I said.
"Quiet, quiet,"
an older man said, then frowned at me.
"Don't I know you?"
"I was with Guthrum at Redingham," I said, "and at Wareham."
"Well, that must be it. He's done better this time, then."
"He's done better," I agreed. The man pointed at his ult.
"Yours?"
"Not for sale."
"Just asking, friend, just asking."
Aenfled brought us stale bread, cold pork, wrinkled apples and a rock-hard cheese, in which red worms writhed. The older man carried a pot of ale to our table, evidently as a peace offering, and he sat and talked with me, and I learned a little more of what was happening. Guthrum had brought close to 3,000 men to attack Sippenham. Guthrum himself was now in Alfred's hall, and half his men would stay in Sippenham as a garrison, while the rest planned to ride either south or west in the morning.
"Keep the bastards on the run, eh?"
the man said, then frowned at Leofric. He doesn't say much. He's dumb, I said. I knew a man who had a dumb wife. He was ever so happy.
He looked jealously at my arm rings.
So, who do you serve?
Svein of the White Horse.
Svein? He wasn't at Reading or at Wareham.
He was in Difflin, I said. But I was with Ragnar the Older then.
Ah, Ragnar. Poor bastard.
I suppose his son's dead now, I asked.
What else?
The man said.
Hostages. Poor bastards.
He thought for a heartbeat, then frowned again.
What's Svein doing here? I thought he was coming by ship.
He is, I said. We're just here to talk to Guthrum.
Svein sends a dumb man to talk to Guthrum?
He sent me to talk, I said. And sent him, I jerked a thumb at the glowering Leofric, to kill people who ask too many questions.
All right, all right.
The man held up a hand to ward off my belligerence. We slept in the stable loft, warmed by straw, and we left before dawn. And at that moment, 50 West Saxons could have retaken Sippenham, for the Danes were drunk, sleeping and oblivious to the world. Leofric stole a sword, axe and shield from a man snoring in the tavern. Then we walked unchallenged out of the western gate. In a field outside we found over 100 horses, guarded by 2 men sleeping in a thatched hut, and we could have taken all the beasts, but we had no saddles or bridles, and so, reluctantly, I knew we must walk. There were 4 of us now, because Einflaed had decided to come with us. She had swathed Isolde in 2 big cloaks, but the British girl was still shivering. We walked west and south, along a road that twisted through small hills. We were heading for Bartham, and from there I could strike south towards Defnershire and my son, but it was clear the Danes were already ahead of us. Some must have ridden this way the previous day, for in the first village we reached there were no cocks crowing, no sound at all, and what I had taken for a morning mist was smoke from burned cottages. Heavier smoke showed ahead, suggested the Danes might already have reached Bartham, a town they knew well, for they had negotiated one of their truces there. Then, that afternoon, a horde of mounted Danes appeared on the road behind us, and we were driven west into the hills to find a hiding place. We wandered for a week. We found shelter in hovels. Some were deserted, while others still had frightened folk, but every short winter's day was smeared with smoke as the Danes ravaged Wessex. One day we discovered a cow trapped in its byre in an otherwise deserted homestead. The cow was with calf, and bellowing with hunger. And that night we feasted on fresh meat. Next day we could not move, for it was bitterly cold, and a slanting rain slashed on an east wind, and the trees thrashed as if in agony, and the building that gave us shelter leaked, and the fire choked us, and Isolde just sat, eyes wide and empty, staring into the small flames. "You want to go back to Cornwallham?" I asked her. She seemed surprised I had spoken. It took her a few heartbeats to gather her thoughts. Then she shrugged.
"What is there for me?" "Whom?"
Einflaed said.
"Uhtred is home for me."
"Uhtred is married,"
Einflaed said harshly. Isolde ignored that.
"Uhtred will lead men,"
she said, rocking back and forth.
"Hundreds of men. A bright horde. I want to see that."
"He'll lead you into temptation. That's all he'll do," Einflaed said.
"Go home, girl. Say your prayers and hope the Danes don't come."
We kept trying to go southwards, and we made some small progress every day. But the bitter days were short, and the Danes seemed to be everywhere. Even when we travelled across countryside far from any track or path, there would be a patrol of Danes in the distance.
and to avoid them, we were constantly driven west. To our east was the Roman road that ran from Bartham, and eventually to Exoncester, the main thoroughfare in this part of Wessex. And I suppose the Danes were using it and sending patrols out to either side of the road. And it was those patrols that drove us ever nearer the Severn Sea. But there could be no safety there, for Svein would surely have come from Wales. I also suppose that Wessex had finally fallen. We met a few folk, fugitives from their villages and hiding in the woods, but none had any news, only rumour. No one had seen any West Saxon soldiers. No one had heard about Alfred. They only saw Danes and the ever-present smoke. From time to time we would come across a ravaged village or a burned church. We would see ragged ravens flapping black and follow them to find rotting bodies. We were lost, and any hope I had of reaching Oxton was long gone, and I assumed Mildreth had fled west into the hills as the folk around the Usk always did when the Danes came. I hoped she was alive. I hoped my son lived. But what future he had was as dark as the long winter nights. "Maybe we should make our peace," I suggested to Leofric one night. We were in a shepherd's hut, crouched around a small fire that filled the low turf-roofed building with smoke. We'd roasted a dozen mutton ribs, cut from a sheep's half-eaten corpse. We were all filthy, damp, and cold. "Maybe we should find the Danes," I said, "and swear allegiance."
"And be made slaves," Leofric answered bitterly.
"We'll be warriors," I said.
"Fighting for a Dane?"
He poked the fire, throwing up a new burst of smoke.
"We can't have taken all Wessex," he protested.
"Why not?"
"It's too big. There have to be some men fighting back. We just have to find them."
I thought back to the long-ago arguments in Lundeen. Back then I had been a child with the Danes, and their leaders had argued that the best way to take Wessex was to attack its western heartland, and there break its power. Others had wanted to start the assault by taking the old kingdom of Kent, the weakest part of Wessex, and the part which contained the great shrine of Contwaraburg. But the boldest argument had won. They had attacked in the west, and that first assault had failed. But now Guthrum had succeeded. Yet how far had he succeeded? Was Kent still Saxon? Devonshire?
"And what happens to Mildreth if you join the Danes?" Leofric asked.
"She'll have hidden." I spoke dully, and there was a silence. But I saw Eanfleed was offended, and I hoped she would hold her tongue. She did not.
"Do you care?"
she challenged me.
"I care," I said.
Eanfleed scorned that answer.
"Grown dull, has she?"
"Of course he cares."
Leofric tried to be a peacemaker.
"She's a wife,"
Eanfleed retorted, still looking at me.
"Men tire of wives,"
she went on, and Isolt listened, her big dark eyes going from me to Eanfleed.
"What do you know of wives?" I asked.
"I was married,"
Eanfleed said.
"You were?"
Leofric asked, surprised.
"I was married for 3 years,"
Eanfleed said,
"to a man who was in Wulfhere's guard. He gave me 2 children, then died in the battle that killed King Ethelred."
"2 children?
Isolt asked.
"They died,"
Eanfleed said harshly.
"That's what children do. They die."
"You were happy with him?"
Leofric asked.
"Your husband?"
"For about 3 days,"
she said.
"And in the next 3 years, I learned that men are bastards."
"All of them?"
Leofric asked.
"Most."
She smiled at Leofric, then touched his knee.
"Not you."
"And me?"
I asked.
"You?"
She looked at me for a heartbeat.
"I wouldn't trust you as far as I could spit,"
she said. and there was real venom in her voice, leaving Leofric embarrassed and me surprised. There comes a moment in life when we see ourselves as others see us. I suppose that's part of growing up, and it's not always comfortable. Eanfleed, at that moment, regretted speaking so harshly, for she tried to soften it.
"I don't know you," she said, "except you're Leofric's friend." "Uhtred is generous,"
Isolde said loyally.
"Men are usually generous when they want something,"
Eanfleed retorted.
"I want Bebbanburg," I said.
"Whatever that is,"
Eanfleed said.
"And to get it, you'd do anything. Anything."
There was silence. I saw a snowflake show at the half-covered door. It fluttered into the firelight and melted.
"Well, Alfred's a good man,"
Leofric brought the awkward silence.
"He tries to be good,"
Eanfleed said.
"Only tries," I asked sarcastically.
"He's like you,"
she said.
"He'd kill to get what he wants. But there is a difference. He has a conscience."
"Well, he's frightened of the priests, you mean?"
"He's frightened of God. And we should all be that. Because one day we'll answer to God."
"Not me," I said. Eanfleed sneered at that, but Leofric changed the conversation by saying it was snowing, and after a while we slept. Isolde clung to me in her sleep, and she whimpered and twitched as I lay awake, half-dreaming, thinking of her words that I would lead a bright horde. It seemed an unlikely prophecy. Indeed, I reckoned her powers must have gone with her virginity. And then I slept too, waking to a world made white. The twigs and branches were edged with snow, but it was already melting, dripping into a misty dawn. When I went outside, I found a tiny dead wren just beyond the door, and I feared it was a grim omen. Leofric emerged from the hut, blinking at the dawn's brilliance.
"Don't mind, Eanfleed," he said.
"I don't.
Her world's come to an end."
"Then we must remake it," I said.
"Well, does that mean you won't join the Danes?"
"I'm a Saxon," I said. Leofric half-smiled at that. He undid his breeches and had a piss.
"If your friend Ragnar was alive,"
he asked, watching the steam rise from his urine,
"would you still be a Saxon?"
"He's dead, isn't he?" I said bleakly. "Sacrificed to Guthrum's ambition."
"So now you're a Saxon?"
"I'm a Saxon," I said again, sounding more certain than I felt, for I did not know what the future held.
"How can we?"
Perhaps Isolde had told the truth, and Alfred would give me power, and I would lead a shining horde and have a woman of gold. But I was beginning to doubt Isolde's powers. Alfred might already be dead, and his kingdom was doomed, and all I knew at that moment was that the land stretched away south to a snow-covered ridgeline. And there it ended, in a strange, empty brightness. The skyline looked like the world's rim, poised above an abyss of pearly light.
"We'll keep going south," I said.
There was nothing else to do, except walk towards the brightness. We did. We followed a sheep track to the ridge top, and there I saw that the hills fell steeply away, dropping to the vast marshes of the sea. We had come to the great swamp, and the brightness I had seen was the winter light reflecting from the long meres and winding creeks.
"What now?" Leofric asked.
And I had no answer, and so we sat under the berries of a wind-bent yew, and stared at the immensity of bog, water, grass, and reeds. This was the vast swamp that stretched inland from the Severn, and if I was to reach Devonshire, I either had to go around it or try to cross it. If we went around it, then we would have to go to the Roman road, and that was where the Danes were. But if we tried to cross the swamp, we would face other dangers. I'd heard a thousand stories of men being lost in its wet tangles, It was said there were spirits there, spirits that showed at night as flickering lights, and there were paths that led only to quicksands or to drowning pools. But there were also villages in the swamp, places where folk trapped fish and eels. The people of the swamp were protected by the spirits, and by the sudden surges in the tide that could drown a road in an eye blink. Now, as the last snows melted from the reed banks, the swamp looked like a great stretch of waterlogged land, its streams and meres swollen by the winter rains. But when the tide rose, it would resemble an inland sea, dotted with islands. We could see one of those islands not so far off, and there was a cluster of huts on that speck of higher ground. And that would be a place to find food and warmth, if we could ever reach it. Eventually we might cross the whole swamp, finding a way from island to island. But it would take far longer than a day, and we would have to find refuge at every high tide. I gazed at the long, cold stretches of water, almost black beneath the leaden clouds that came from the sea, and my spirits sank, for I did not know where we were going, or why, or what the future held. It seemed to get colder as we sat, and then a light snow began drifting from the dark clouds. Just a few flakes, but enough to convince me that we had to find shelter soon. Smoke was rising from the nearest swamp village, evidence that some folk still lived there. There would be food in their hovels, and a meagre warmth. "We have to get to that island," I said, pointing. But the others were staring westwards, to where a flock of pigeons had burst from the trees at the foot of the slope. The birds rose and flew in circles.
"Someone's there," Leofric said.
We waited. The pigeons settled in the trees higher up the hill.
"Well, maybe it's a boar," I suggested. "Pigeons won't fly from a boar," Leofric said. "Boars don't startle pigeons any more than stags do. There are folk there."
The thought of boars and stags made me wonder what had happened to my hounds. Had Mildred abandoned them? I'd not even told her where I had hidden the remains of the plunder we had taken off the coast of Wales. I dug a hole in a corner of my new hall and buried the gold and silver down by the post-stone. But it was not the cleverest hiding place, and if there were Danes in Oxton, then they were bound to delve into the edges of the hall floor, especially if a probing spear found a place where the earth had been disturbed. A flight of ducks flew overhead. The snow was falling harder, blurring the long view across the swamp.
"Priests," Leofric said.
There were a half-dozen men off to the west. They were robed in black and had come from the trees to walk along the swamp's margin, plainly seeking a path into its tangled vastness. But there was no obvious track to the small village on its tiny island, and so the priests came nearer to us, skirting the ridge's foot. One of them was carrying a long staff, and even at a distance I could see a glint at its head, and I suspected it was a bishop's staff, the kind with a heavy silver cross. Another three carried heavy sacks.
"Well, you think there's food in those bundles?" Leofric asked wistfully.
"They're priests," I said savagely. "They'll be carrying silver."
"Or books," Aenfleet suggested.
"Priests like books."
"Where could be food," Leofric said, though not very convincingly.
A group of three women and two children now appeared. One of the women was wearing a swathing cloak of silver fur, while another carried the smaller child. The women and children were not far behind the priests, who waited for them, and then they all walked eastwards until they were beneath us, and there they discovered some kind of path twisting into the marshes. Five of the priests led the women into the swamp, while the sixth man, evidently younger than the others, hurried back westwards.
"Where's he going?" Leofric asked.
Another skein of ducks flighted low overhead, skimming down the slope to the long meres of the swamp. Nets, I thought. There must be nets in the swamp villages, and we could trap fish and wildfowl. We could eat well for a few days. Eels, duck, fish, geese. If there were enough nets, we could even trap deer by driving them into the tangling